Welcome, welcome, Brightsiders. It is podcast time again. We're a little bit delayed. We apologize for that. So hopefully we deliver. I have some groundbreaking news that I'm going to give to everybody. So hopefully that makes up for the 24-hour delay, give or take, on the podcast going up here on Thursday. But it's episode 42. In terms of 42, I mean, it's just Jackie Robinson. That's the only thing I can think of off the top of my head. You don't even got to do research on that. But with this podcast here, like I said, I got some earth-shattering news. I'm not going to make you guys wait for it. I'm actually going to give that to you now. And I actually have a nice little audio clip that's going to explain the significance and the power of the number 42. I'm about to drop some knowledge on you, Brightsiders.
Deep thought. Do you have
an answer for you? Yes, but you're not going to like it.
It doesn't matter. We must know it.
All right. The answer to the ultimate question of life, the universe, and everything is... ...42. Yes, I thought it over quite thoroughly. It is, it's 42.
So, as I said, hopefully that doesn't disappoint. The answer to life and everything in the universe is the number 42, meaning this podcast is the pinnacle. I don't think it gets better than this. And to help me out along the way here, Dave King jumping on once again with the podcast as we continue our round robin through the world of the Brightside universe. Dave, what did you think of the answer to the ultimate question, life, the universe, and everything being 42?
Wow, that's pretty incredible. I never would have thought that in 42 years.
Yeah, so, and I think that 42 is right about the, I think 40 is the age where everyone starts subtracting and talking about being in their 20s and birthdays repeating and all that fun stuff. But yeah, you know, episode 42, we landed in the preseason. We got a handful of games under our belts here from a viewer's standpoint from watching the Phoenix Suns and this new product that they're trotting out there this season. You were actually at the game last night. I wasn't able to get there to the game against the Clippers, which I mistakenly thought was a game against the Oklahoma City Thunder. If it was the Clippers, I probably would have made a little bit more of an effort to get out to the game. But they play the Clippers. The rally comes up short. They fall behind early, lose to the Clippers. But I guess more of the story, because it's just a preseason game, is Alvin Gentry and Jared Dudley were in a visitor's locker room. What did you take away from the game and your experience there with them as visitors?
Well, you know, I thought it was a pretty interesting game. First of all, pregame was pretty nice. The Clippers coach, Doc Rivers, generally doesn't have his assistants talking to media at any time, but he was all over having Alvin talk to us. He, in fact, pushed Alvin out of the locker room after he was done with his own pregame interview. He's like, "Oh, you guys want Alvin, don't you?" And we said, "Sure, of course." And he actually grabbed Alvin out of the locker room, pushed him out. Of course, it was all play acting. Alvin was ready to talk to us. And then the first thing Alvin says out of his mouth, or at least the first memorable thing he says out of his mouth, is, and that was tweeted all over the place and included in game stories, was, "I had 8 great years here. You don't want to hear 9, right?" so he expressed just a lot of appreciation for Phoenix, a lot of love for the town. His kids are still here. Everyone's still here. They're doing the Steve Nash thing where they're doing the commuting back and forth to L.A. It's like that's just the L.A. Express going on lately. He has a lot of great memories here. So, and I read something from Coro, although I didn't hear it last night, but I read something from Coro that anybody could have read in an article today that says that the Suns have been trying to patch things up with Gentry. I'm not sure what that really means other than, hey, look, this was better for everybody that we all parted, but I'm sorry it happened the way it did, because it really needed to happen last year. Gentry is not a perfect coach for kids and to teach them every little thing about being an NBA basketball player. Gentry is much better as a strategist. And if you don't have the right staff to teach kids, then it wasn't going to be successful. He was put into a bad situation last year anyway because he had a team that was half veteran, half kids, more veterans than kids, actually. And And so it wasn't perfect for him, but I think overall everybody, as Coro wrote today, is in a better place, and that's the most important thing.
Yeah, and I think from media day to practices to the actual games, anytime you talk to Gentry and anytime you got a general, it just, there was a vibe around the arena that his days were unfortunately numbered. I mean, I don't think anybody's going to throw Alvin Gentry on the Mount Rushmore of Phoenix Suns coaches or on the Mount Rushmore of NBA coaches or anything like that. He's not in this elite pantheon like maybe, you know, Doc Rivers, the guy throwing him out the door is. But he's a guy that was respected out here, but it just, you got that vibe. It just felt like he wasn't Lance Blanks's guy, or he, you know, he wasn't necessarily Lon Babby's guy. But, you know, this is a good old boys network in the NBA where it's, you know, it's almost like a brotherhood and a connection, as you hear players talk about all the time. So hopefully they are patching that up, and, you know, maybe a future role for Gentry down the road. I don't really see that. But then again, Gentry was with the Clippers about 13, 14 years ago, and he's back there with them now. So, you know, it's good to see him in a good situation, though. And I think that's the one thing that fans and everybody out in Arizona, you know, if Steve Nash won with LA last year, I don't think they would have cared. They'd have been happy for Nash. And it'll be the same thing for Dudley, same thing for Gentry. They were just beloved figures out here, and people just want to see them succeed.
No, absolutely. Everybody just loves, I mean, just Phoenix doesn't hold grudges. We're eventually going to forgive Nash. In fact, many of us already have. Certainly it makes it easier to swallow when when the Lakers failed miserably, because they're the mighty Lakers who we pray to fail. And the fact that he jumped on that ship just as it was going down and is continuing to go down, you know, it doesn't make the pill any more bitter to swallow. It actually makes it sweeter. So I think we're doing well. But in Gentry's case, I think people are going to be happy if the Clippers do win a championship with him on the bench. I mean, we really want only the best things for Gentry. He was a nice guy. He was great with the media. He really knew how to play his cards. When things weren't going well with the front office, he played up the media, and that left him in a better light than he otherwise would have had. You know, not naming names, but there was a coach after him that didn't leave on great terms with the media or the front office, and you hardly ever hear his name again. So, but Gentry definitely left a good legacy here. He has great memories from the 09-10 team, like all those guys do. And they will always have that in their back pocket.
One player that comes to mind that I'll kind of counter-argue on that with holding grudges is, but there's also a caveat that I'll bring up that kind of counters what I'm about to say. So I'm going to argue my own point against myself. But
you go right ahead, Chris.
I'll do that. I'm good at that. If I didn't have you on the phone right now, Dave, I would be arguing with myself on this podcast. one player is Amari Stoudemire. I think initially the fans held a grudge against, and they did for a little while. And then when they realized the cap relief and the production that he's giving and the contract that he got, I think that over time afterwards, they kind of just, like, people didn't admit that they were wrong, but people just kind of snickered and went, well, we dodged a bullet with that one. So I think folks they held a grudge a little bit against Amari and the fact that he wasn't here with the team, but then they kind of, like, look over their shoulder and go, well, that's behind us. We don't have to worry about that anymore. Let's dust our hands and keep walking.
And, you know, I think people held as much or more of a grudge against the Suns. I think there was definitely a polarizing effect when he left, but the majority at the moment he left, and certainly when he was playing at MVP caliber for about 3 months in New York,
yeah,
there was a lot of, doom, which eventually did happen for the Suns. They doomed themselves with who they replaced him with, but that's old news. And now, since then, it's gone from bitterness on some people's parts for Amari for leaving and taking the $100 million. I think that's simply just, you know, a little bit of jealousy and a little bit of disappointment that why aren't we good enough, more so than not liking the person himself. I mean, it's really hard not to like. He wasn't the brightest bulb in the universe, but he certainly was a good guy, and people did like him.
Yeah, and you bring up that New York stuff, and I think people forget that pre-Carmelo, not to turn this into an NBA podcast that's 3 years old, but the pre-Carmelo Amari Stoudemire team had a very, you know, Golden State kind of Denver-y vibe, where it was one star surrounded by a fantastic cast, or I should say a fringe star, because, you know, Steph Curry's a tremendous player, but I'm not ready to put him up there in that that top 10 great NBA players area. But, you know, it was a fringe star type player surrounded by a bunch of good players that wouldn't have necessarily beat Miami in a series of seven, but could have definitely contested and been a player in the East for a while with that cast, where they blew it up, brought in Carmelo, and we've seen the results.
And Chris, not to again, we're going to make this a three-year-old podcast. We ought to cut this off pretty quickly. But at the time Amari was doing all this MVP stuff, the Knicks were barely 500, and in fact, they were below 500. So there was no we could play with Miami. There was no they could barely make the playoffs that year. But he was playing individually at an MVP caliber level for a few months. That who knows if that would have lasted without Carmelo Anthony or not. I tend to doubt that it would have lasted. And even during those MVP months, he wasn't playing defense. So, I mean, there is that.
We do all know that side of it, where the defense is definitely not played at a consistent level there. But, yeah, that's and to kind of keep it on the NBA topical stuff, I wanted to kind of sarcastically poke at this at the beginning, and a shout-out to our boy Amin El-Hassan with ESPN that I believe was a part of this. But Kobe Bryant coming through the pipeline Wednesday as the 25th best player in the NBA in a meaningless ranking system. But, you know, it's just fun to kind of see that. And I fought the urge, Dave. I was just going to just run with this whole podcast of Kobe Bryant being the 25th best player in the NBA and see if we can get a full 40 minutes out of it, which probably would have been easy. But I thought that was pretty funny today, just the backlash and the outlash over a fake list and Kobe Bryant being ranked 25th when he's coming in off of an injury.
Well, that the whole thing is just laughable. For one thing, when people take offense at these rankings on behalf of another human being, I'm like, just live your life, you know? But certainly, you know, if you're going to take offense to it, at least try to put it into a little bit of context. We're not talking about a 34-year-old Kobe Bryant who's healthy. We're talking about a 36, 37-year-old Kobe Bryant who's coming off an Achilles injury that almost nobody can come back from. You hear that, you know, he could play if it's a playoff game. Well, yeah, that doesn't mean he's not going to re-hurt himself, and that doesn't mean he's going to play well. It just means that he would put a uniform on, which he already did in the preseason anyway, and walk out onto the court and try to make a bunch of jump shots. So as 25th best player, maybe over the course of the whole season, he'll work himself up to 25th best player in the league after half a season, maybe, of really good play and maybe a month of being Kobe again. But I think he's got a long road ahead of him to even get up to the level of being the 25th most valuable player in the NBA over the course of the season, because the Lakers are already going to be in trouble before he ever shows up to ride his white horse.
Yeah, and that's going to be interesting. So I want to go circle the wagon back to the Jared Dudley coming back in, and we have a lot more stories about beloved sons coming back, you know, with, you know, Jeff Hornacek after he was traded, you know, the new head coach, with you know, Charles Barkley, folks like that. They'd get traded, and we just want to see them succeed somewhere else over the years of the Suns existing, you know, the 40-plus years or so that they've been around. And when you look at that, outside of the Amari example, which I kind of agree to an extent that it was more of people being mad at the Suns, but I think folks were a little bit mad at Amari for not showing a little bit more loyalty, I guess, but that's not really on him. You know, money is money. So if you had to think about that, what are a few examples of players that you think that maybe over the course of the franchise history, you got more of an index in your brain there of the history of the Phoenix Suns? What are some players that come to mind that you think of that there might have been some bad blood and the fans maybe did not want to see them succeed after they left?
You know, that's a good question. There might have been a little bit back when Barkley talked his way out of town only 3 years after coming in town. The Suns lost a couple of heartbreakers to Houston in the mid-90s, as many Suns fans will remember, having had leads in each of those second-round series. I think they were both second round, but the Suns had leads in each of those series, only to lose eventually to Houston, who went to the finals during the 2 years Jordan was out. And then within a year after that, Barkley had talked himself out of town, wanted to team up on somewhat similar to what the Lakers did just last year, where you team up with three dream teamer people and you're suddenly going to win a championship, and oh no, it doesn't work. But he talked himself into that, and the Suns got almost nothing in return. They only got a couple of guys who beat them in the playoffs the last couple of years, and those guys didn't even last half a season, Robert Horry and Sam Cassell. So I think, the Suns did turn, I believe, Cassell into Jason Kidd, if I got my memory straight, with a number of other players as well. So I think, but overall, it just didn't end well with Barkley. But people still love him now. And he loved Phoenix, which really made things a lot easier for fans to remember him in a good light. After the trade got over and the Suns got really screwed on the trade deal, Colangelo's were not gold, by the way. But anyway, the love for Barkley regrew because he stayed in Phoenix, loves Phoenix. And now the anger toward Barkley was only during the mid-2000s when he kept picking the Suns to not make the finals because they didn't play any defense, and he was right about that. As far as other guys leaving, I don't think anyone else who stayed with the Suns for a long period of time left on bad enough terms to still be disliked, although Scott Howard would be a much, much better source on figuring out someone like that. I mean, you could maybe say a Walter Davis, but that was back in the 70s, sorry, in the 80s. But even then, people felt a little bit sorry for him because of the addiction. So I don't really have anybody else off the top of my head that was a longtime son that people dislike. Although maybe there's a little bit of dislike for Sean Marion. He insisted on a Supermax deal, which at the time was in the 20s, $20 million a year, $23 million a year or so, wanting an extension when he was almost 29 years old, and his whole game was based on athleticism. So, and the Suns didn't give it to him, ended up trading him. But the Suns are more mad, or excuse me, fans are more mad at the Suns for having made that trade because of what they got back and how it kind of dismantled the mid-2000s team. So, no, I think fans are pretty forgiving here in Phoenix. There's only, I can't think of hardly anybody that's really disliked still to this day.
Yeah, it's and that's part of when you go back to the fact that this team has always had, outside of the late 80s, has always had quality character, has always been a team that's looked at as a quote-unquote model franchise despite not having a lot of championships. They always had pretty quality ownership. You know, Robert Sarver had a few lean years where folks didn't really like him, and I think now it's just kind of like, you know, old anger that's just continuing, and people just don't educate themselves on what he's been doing over the past 3 to 4 years, I think. But they've always had quality coaching, quality ownership, quality, you know, general manager slash president type people, really good players. I think the Jason Kidd stuff got blown up because of the media, and then people kind of like quieted down on that and the fire went away. And, you know, Stephon Marbury didn't last here long enough for people to not like him because he didn't really produce very much. And, you know, then he ended up landing on New York like all the other ex-Suns. But yeah, there's not a lot
people
of players.
Didn't actually, yeah. People didn't love Stephon Marbury while he was here.
Exactly.
So I don't think it was really the only players you're really going to hate for a long, long time are players that jilted you. And I don't see Stephon Marbury ever having gotten the love of the fans that would make them feel jilted.
Yeah, and I don't think that there's ever really, I think the Steve Nash stuff, as much as it people always, and I'm one of those people that don't think that stuff that happens in the moment has to be labeled as the best or the worst. We kind of went over that with different things like Breaking Bad and like the Steve Nash trade, where folks will immediately say that's the worst or the best thing just because that's what's happening right now. But when you look back on it with hindsight, you could probably make a case that the Steve Nash, you know, asking for a trade and then being moved to the Lakers and the added salt to the wound are the Lakers. But that might be the biggest jilting of the Phoenix Suns. If it would have happened a few years earlier, I would say absolutely. But the kind of the fact that the timing was what it was, you know, the end of his career and there's not much left in the tank there. But you could probably argue that that was the biggest jilting that the Suns have ever had from a player because they were so invested in Steve.
Yeah, absolutely. And where he went. But I think that jilting is going to be lessened if an Archie Goodwin and the 2015 first-round pick develop. But still, you're right. I think that's probably the biggest jilting. I actually pulled up Basketball Reference right now looking at the highest scoring Suns in history, and I'm not seeing anyone who really is feeling that any more jilted than maybe against Steve Nash.
Yeah.
At this point in the Suns' history, I mean, you've got Walter Davis, Alvin Adams, Kevin Johnson, Sean Marion, Dick Van Arsdale. All these guys are either still somewhat associated with the Suns or still living in the community to this day. Dan Marley, Tom Chambers, Larry Nance. Larry Nance was traded when he needed to be traded. I don't think people disliked him. I didn't realize Leandro Barbosa is the 16th highest scoring Phoenix Sun in history. And he started almost no games for us.
Yeah,
so that's interesting.
Probably the best six. I don't want to say he is the best six man because I'm not looking at a list of folks that didn't start a tremendous amount of games, you know, back in the 70s and the 80s. I'm sure there were some quality players, but one could argue best sixth man in the history of the franchise, and a guy that I think he inched up towards. He had a couple of seasons where he was like in between that 16 to 20 points per game coming off of the bench, and he was a closer, not a starter, very Manu Ginobili, Jason Terry-esque. And the fact that he may not have started games because he didn't fit a position, but, you know, closed out games and was a tremendous player for this team. I mean, there was a few years where you could argue that he was broaching on being one of the better six men in the history of the league, and then, you know, it ended up not being like a long-term thing like Ginobili and like some of the other guys that had long runs as six men. And now the Suns have got to figure out who their starters are and who their six men are. I mean, have you... I don't know if the fans have really taken a chance to look at this. I know me and you do, just because it's just stuff that interests us and we got to keep up to what might happen and what is happening. But the Suns, obviously, with the preseason are going to, in Jeff Hornacek's words, tinker around with things. And when you look at it, a lot of guys have started, not started, played a few games, not played a few games. But, I mean, when I'm looking at the preseason numbers, the biggest thing that jumps out at me, Dave, and you can let me know if it's something else for you, but Kendall Marshall, outside of Deontay Christmas, who played one less game than him, has logged the least amount of minutes per game, the least amount of points, the least amount of total minutes. Deontay Christmas has played less total minutes because of less games, but Kendall's at the bottom of the list there in minutes, in points, and it's, you know, for a guy that actually has a contract and is a lottery pick and is supposed to be part of this team, he's below a lot of folks, you know, at least a handful that are probably not even going to make the roster.
Yeah, I do think that's quite interesting. I'm looking at the stats myself, and he has played all four games. He's only averaging 9 minutes per game and 2.5 points and 2 assists. So it's really, really low. However, he's shooting 50% on overall field goals and on three-pointers, and he has driven to the hole a couple of times. He does look a little bit better than he did last year. I think it's got to be, and I don't know anything for sure, but it's got to be a combination of two things. One is that he is on a guaranteed contract. He's only 22 years old. It could be that Hornacek has already decided that he is at least on the team and that he'd rather look at other guys to see if anyone else is going to really jump out. I mean, Hornacek has 17 guys he's got to juggle, and it would be nice if he doesn't have to juggle a couple of them because he knows who they are. However, he's playing Goran Dragic twice those minutes, and Channing Frye has actually almost doubled Kendall Marshall in minutes. So, you know, I don't know what exactly you want to we could read into it. The other factor could just simply be that Marshall doesn't fit Hornacek's game plan. Hornacek is trying to model the team around the two fast drive to the hole point guards who dish it out, whereas Marshall is a slower pass it up the way and have somebody else finish it guy. And so while they both can run fast breaks, they do it in different ways, and maybe that's somewhat disruptive. I'm not really sure. I think it's probably more of the former. Yeah. Marshall's going to have another year in Phoenix, and they already know they're going to do it.
See, and that's the thing where when you talk about the very first thing you said there is that he's played so limited, but I think he's actually played collectively in his 9 minutes a game. I think that he's actually played some of his better ball. I mean, I know preseason action and whatever you want to take from it, but from the games that I saw, you know, live, the game against Maccabee and then the games on TV and whatnot, he's actually played pretty well. He looks like he's a little bit stronger. He looks like he's got a little bit more confidence in his jump shot. He's shooting 50% from three, albeit on 4 attempts, and 50% from the field on 8 attempts. So not a lot to go off of there. And a lot of his production came in that Maccabee game where he had 4 of his 8 assists and logged actually a quality amount of minutes there at the end of the game. So, you know, when you think about it, in the 3 preseason games, he scored 8 points and had 4 assists and played a dramatically lesser role, like not a lot of time actually on the court getting a lot of minutes. So there's some things you got to read out of it, but also when you look at the structure of the roster and who might or might not make the team, it makes more sense to let go maybe guys like Malcolm Lee or Ish Smith and these guards that don't really have a spot because, you know, Goran and Eric are going to start together, and then one's probably going to come out, and then they'll switch those guys around here and there to where one of them is probably on the court, at least either at all times or maybe to the extent of like 42 to 45 minutes a game, at least one of them will be on the court. So having a bunch of backup point guards doesn't make sense. I get looking at them and then maybe getting a feel for later on down the road, but do you really want to look at Ish Smith for more minutes than Kendall Marshall for a contract in 2015 versus, you know, getting Kendall some reps and seeing if he can play with these guys that he's going to be on the court with?
Yeah, something just occurred to me, and those are good points, Chris. Now, something just occurred to me as I was listening to you and after I'd done my own feedback on why I think Marshall isn't getting many minutes, and so I'm just going to think it through out loud. It may make no sense at all, but there was the rumor during the summer that from people connected to NBA circles that McDonough was trying to include Marshall in any summer deal. By extension, and it doesn't look like to me that Marshall fits perfectly with Hornacek's offense, although I could be completely wrong on that. He also didn't lift his shot at all over the summer. He's gotten more consistent with it, but he's still shooting it from the chest, basically, going up through his face to deliver, you know, to push the ball off. So he hasn't changed his motion at all, and Hornacek did comment that he hadn't raised a shot after the beginning of the summer. Hornacek said he really needed to raise a shot. So it's quite possible that the Suns really do want to trade Kendall Marshall. And if that's the case, you have to wonder why Marshall is getting the fewest minutes on the team. Generally, when you want to trade somebody, you want to showcase them. However, it's quite... so the only conclusion you could make, maybe, is that the less is more. The less Kendall Marshall gets exposed on a basketball court, the more chance the Suns might be able to include him in a trade without having to add a draft pick to it. So I'm just following a little bit of conjecture here. What do you think of that?
See, and I agree with that wholeheartedly when you add in the respect that you have to go full on with whichever method you go. I think what gets a lot of people in trouble is that if they want to trade somebody, they'll play them out of need for 25 minutes one game, but then go, oh, we don't want to showcase him because he can't do it. You know, we need to play him, like DNP him for the next four games, and then play him out of need for 20 minutes the next game. That's where you end up getting in trouble. You know, Shannon Brown last year, I think, could have had trade value if you just hit him on your bench and people are like, whoa, Shannon Brown's not playing. Let's go get him. I wonder if he still has something. But then they would DNP him for nine games and put him out there for 17 minutes randomly in a game, and he'd be a little rusty and, you know, maybe not knock down all of his shots and look a little off. So if you're going to if you're gonna do what you're talking about, yeah, you either go full on. You play him 20 minutes a game as your backup, or you play him, like, you know, 5 to 6 minutes consistently just to get him out there and let his knees, you know, not be sitting in that position the entire time on the bench other than waving a towel. So I agree with what you're saying, as long as if they're consistent with what they do. I don't want to see him go out there in the next preseason game then and start and play 27 minutes. That would be my thing with that.
Right, yes. And plus, Hornacek said yesterday in the pregame that he was getting to the point where he was ready to start playing his regulars more in the last couple of preseason games. He's going to go one more preseason game of mixing it up and experimentation, but then after that he's going to start settling in. So there's really not many opportunities left for them to over-showcase Kendall Marshall. But again, going back to your point, Chris, he does look better than last year. He just doesn't necessarily yet look like a guy who can run a team in the NBA. But, you know, he's making progress. He certainly has gotten himself into great shape, and he is looking quicker and more decisive. And that's a product of age. I mean, the guy was only 21 last year.
Yeah. Yeah. As much as you say he's got an old man game and he's mature and he's this and he's that, he's still 21. I mean, he can be mature in a two-minute interview, but still be a 21-year-old. So a lot of things to go over. And if we play the – we didn't get a chance to go into it a ton, and that's fine. We wrote enough about it to where we don't need to talk about it. But, you know, if we go into that concept of the 2K14 strategy of, you know, spending the entire summer getting better at one thing, if he – whether it's shooting, like you had said, and others have said, which is definitely an answer, or, you know, going into the Andre Miller school of, you know, getting better on the post and maybe strengthening up that upper body a little bit and being able to actually lumber around with that 6'4 frame. So I don't know if he's done either of those. He looks like he's in better shape. His shot is going in more, but he's not shooting it a ton, so it's hard with that.
Well, he's not even trying to post anybody up,
yeah.
So he has not made it a point, and the coach has not made it a point to get him into a scoring position that take advantage of his size. He has not done anything. He said last year he'd love to be an Andre Miller type. Well, forget the defense part. Andre Miller figured out on offense how to use his body to get separation, because Miller doesn't have any lift on his shot either. But he's figured out how to at least be dangerous with it, and Marshall hasn't done anything really. They haven't even run one play with him in the post. So they're definitely not using his body yet, and he hasn't lifted his shot. So there are those big limitations. Actually, what I wrote in the thing was, yeah, if I had to pick one, it'd be shooting for sure, but one skill isn't enough to get him to be an NBA rotation caliber player on a good team.
Yeah, and you know what? It's easy to go, hey, yeah, he could be Andre Miller, and it's easy for him to say, hey, I can be Andre Miller because we're both, you know, 6'4"-ish, we're both bigger, we're a little bit slower, but we have great passing, and we're good leaders and all that fun stuff. It's one thing to think that, but let's also not forget that Andre Miller, when you discount the Magic Johnson and Oscar Robertsons of the world, the folks that are the big, big point guards, he's probably, next to Dennis Johnson, Andre Miller is probably the best posting point guard and probably a top 10 post-up guard in general in the history of the NBA. So it's not just like, oh, Andre Miller, you know, gets down there and posts a little bit. I think that one of the first few games Lindsey Hunter came in, I asked him, hey, do you plan on using, you know, Kendall in the post at all? Is that even something that's dawned on you guys? Because that's something that it feels like could be taken advantage of. And it was a game against Sacramento to be the reason why I asked that question, because of Isaiah Thomas. I remember this very vividly. And he said, yeah, we actually had him run a couple of things in practice, and then you'll see it in the game. And then the next game, they ran two post-up plays for Kendall Marshall, one where Isaiah Thomas completely bullied him off of the block, and another one where he forced up a bad shot and missed it. And I remember that extremely vividly because you're watching 5'9", if that, Isaiah Thomas completely bully and throw Kendall Marshall off of the block, and it was comical because it looked like Big Brother posting up Little Brother, but Little Brother just completely pushed him out of the way and said, you're not getting this on me. And if Kendall can add that to his game or add, you know, a consistent jumper to his game, it's one thing to be unathletic. It's another thing to be unathletic and not be able to shoot slash score. And that's where Kendall's at with his career right now.
Yep. So we'll see how he progresses, but he's definitely going to be, he's either going to be traded or on the team for another year.
Yeah, I can agree with that. Real quick thoughts on, has anything changed since the initial time we broke out the who do you think will be the starting five question? Anything changed in your mind? You still running with Marcus as your starting three?
You know, I still am, and I just posted an article this afternoon after talking to Marcus last night, somewhat inadvertently, but ultimately it ended up being a really good interview. but anyway, he basically sees himself as a shooter, and he has proven it over in Houston. He could make almost 40% of his threes shooting from the corner as being a spacer for the James Harden show. So I definitely think the Suns need a three-point shooter in the starting lineup, and P.J. Tucker would be awesome off the bench, and he can be a closer as well. But the Suns really need overall the spacing on the floor to make Bledsoe and Dragic work the best.
Yeah, there's not a James Harden shot here in Phoenix, but I get where he's coming from with Goran and Eric and the way that they attack. To where that he can kind of be that spacer. You know, we talked about this a little bit. This is kind of like I don't even call it insidery talks that makes us feel like we're important, which I don't necessarily think that too much of myself. Dave, you're clearly important.
Yeah, right. Shut up.
we had a nice conversation with a slew of different knowledgeable folks at the previous home game, and there was a lot of conversation about the, I don't want to call them the worst interviews, but the worst enunciators, the folks with bad elocution when it comes, like folks that say drag itch like or Dragic instead of drag itch like I do. And I think, would Marcus Morris, Markieff Morris, you've talked to them now for a little over a year, would they go on that pantheon of just folks that are really tough to interview just because of their conversational skills and the way that they talk?
Well, that's quite interesting, and this probably leads into, I should go full disclosure, I mentioned it in the game thread or the recap last night. I interviewed who I thought was Markieff Morris for about 2 minutes last night before I realized it was Marcus. And that was only when Marcus pointed it out to me, because I was asking him how that he was playing the five last year and would he do it again this year. And he's like, you know, I'm Marcus, right? And I said, oh, Jesus Christ. I threw something out like that, inappropriate, but I was totally shocked. He's like, no, it's all good, man. It's all good. That's the first time that's ever happened, but it's all good. I can't believe that's the first time anyone's gotten those two confused because Markieff was not in the room. And I just assumed, you know, I wanted to talk to Markieff after the game, so I just assumed that was him and walked up to him. People are going to make fun of me about that for years, if not decades. But I probably won't be around the Suns for that long for that to happen. But anyway, I had a really good conversation with Marcus last night. Marcus was actually very open, and that's part of the reason I didn't even try to figure out what was going on, because suddenly a Morris was being very open and and honest with his feedback. Although, you know, honest in the terms of this is where I'm sitting right now and this is how I can help, but no mention of how I can get better. And then I got to Markeith later, and Markeith gave me about five-word answers so to my individual questions. So, and mumbled the whole time. And even when I was transcribing the Marcus interview, while he was very eloquent and spoke pretty well, it was so low I had to turn on my volume on my headphones to the max just to hear him. So, yeah, I would say they're pretty bad. I would say Eric Bledsoe is going to have a chance of eclipsing them this year because he is such a low speaker as well, and everything that comes out of his mouth is a platitude of, I'm just working on everything, I'm working on everything, I'm trying to get better in all areas. But last night he was particularly clear, and he made some comments because it was a night he had played against his mentor. So he had a pretty good interview, but in the past it's been a pretty disappointing interview there too. I think the only really good interview for the Suns this year potentially was going to be Channing Frye on positive side, and then the returning Marcin Gortat on the, oh my gosh, did he just say that side. I think he's, Marcin Gortat is the best gold interview for reporters. Channing's the best interview for Suns people. So, yeah, but the Suns have several guys that are kind of down the list on interview level.
Yeah, I don't want to go full-on Grantland Minnesota Timberwolves preview with the uncensored button there. I think they dropped a few F-bombs. I don't know if Disney ESPN caught that. But Marcin Gortat told you they want to run the out of the ball, you know, this year. And he's always fun. He's always a good interview. But to make you feel a little bit better on that note, last time I talked to the Harrison brothers, Kentucky kids that are going to be freshmen this year, walked up to Aaron Harrison, started asking him very pointed Andrew Harrison questions. And the exact thing he said, was, you know, I'm Aaron, right? I play shooting guard. And I'm like, oh, shnikes.
Terrible, you know, and all of a sudden it got really hot in that locker room, man.
Well, that's when you turn the professional switch on and you have questions loaded up for that guy in particular, and you at least have one, that way you can get him talking and forgetting. You say something funny and you kind of, hopefully they laugh, and then you're able to run with the rest of the interview there. But
I did do pretty well. We both laughed it off. He put his arm around me and said, don't worry, it's all right. And then I actually had three or four Marcus questions because I had meant to talk to him as well. And it all turned out really good. People are going to remind me of that for a long time.
Yeah. No, and the reason I brought that up is because there's so many different ways you can, you know, create a Mount Rushmore of, and again, I'm not going to call them bad interviewers. I'm going to just say that either elocution or English language problems. And we talked about how Shaq gets started and then trails off, how Steve Nash can almost get down to the very smallest sound on the decimal level there. We talked about how, like, the Marcus and Markeith, you need a Philly translator for them sometimes, and, you know, folks from other countries, obviously, with the language barrier. So, yeah, I think that we've had over the years a few guys that make it real fun in terms of interviewing, whether it's trying to understand what they said via transcription or, you know, getting someone like Slava to give you something more than, what did he say, I bring the pain, what was his quote?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, I bring the pain.
Yeah.
After he tries to get you to actually pronounce his name correctly.
There you go. See, something funny.
That's just a lot of stuff.
Yeah. So, all right, good. So you're still rolling with Marcus. I still think that I'll lean on something Hornacek said once when I was talking to him about it, which is, you know, the guys that are grasping the system the most, either just that they're soaking it in or their experience and they've been here, are the guys that are probably going to have the best chance of starting, and not saying that they're going to finish the season or the preseason there. And I'll still go with the dual point guards with PJ, Markeith, and Marcin. And I think that PJ and Markeith are two guys that are going to probably be in and out of the starting lineup, or potentially could be the ones that lose their job out of need for shooting with PJ, or out of underperformance potentially with Markeith if he ends up having these kind of like up and down lulls that he's been, you know, seeing over the past, not just this preseason, but the last, like, you know, 40 to 60 games last year too. He didn't have the best sophomore campaign last season.
You know, Markeith, I'm looking at the preseason stats, he's actually second on the team minutes per game. It's only everybody's in the teens except for Kendall Marshall at 9 and Eric Bledsoe at 22.8. But Markeith is the only guy other than Bledsoe over at 20 or more minutes per game. So he's actually getting the minutes on the floor, a little bit ahead of his brother Marcus at 18, and everyone else is in the teens. And Markieff is, you know, putting in 9 points a game and 3.5 rebounds, which if you put that up to the 26 minutes a game he was getting, last year, he's about equal production, maybe slightly down on the rebounds. But the Suns have been rebounding pretty well this preseason. They've got 42 rebounds a game versus 37 by their opponents. In fact, the Suns are better than their opponents as a team just about across the board this entire preseason of the whole four games that have been played.
Yeah, it's the thing that gets you with Markieff is power forwards that shoot under 50% are more commonly going to end up being like your backups or guys that maybe aren't as high productive. I mean, you want your fives, you want them to shoot in the neighborhood of 55 plus, hopefully, because they're everything's at the rim, and your four men, you know, taking out the stretch fours out of the equation a little bit. But even those guys still shoot generally in the neighborhood of 50% from the field because they're still doing stuff in the paint. But I think Markieff has perpetually been in that like 43 to 46 area, and he's a guy that just needs to get more high percentage shots because he takes a lot of Kobe-esque shots that only guys like Kobe can shoot. You don't want to shoot a ton of leaners, but it feels like that's more of his wide open standstill jump shot versus just a wide open standstill jump shot. He tries to take a lot of leaners, a lot of floaters, a lot of runners.
He does. In fact, last night he had two. I just could not believe it. I did a facepalm each time. Driving in from the three-point line and then a runner line drive, one-handed shot from the free throw line. And surprisingly, they bounced off the back of the rim and almost went out of bounds. They bounced so high. So I don't know what he's thinking on his finishes, and he's trying too hard. But going back to the shooting part, Marcus, and my argument for getting him in the starting lineup to be the shooter, along with Channing Frye eventually at the power forward with Marcus at the small forward, I really think that Marcus can do it. In this four preseason games, he's hitting 58% of his threes. He's 7 for 12, so he's even got a high volume of attempts. In fact, he is second to Channing Frye on three-point attempts in the preseason, and he's doing very well, and he did very well in the summer league as well.
Yeah, I can definitely, you know what, that actually brings up a fairly fun lineup where you do have two quasi centers with Frye and Gortat. You have your two point guards out there and then Marcus as the shooter. That could end up being a fun lineup, even if they just do that for, you know, 10 to 12 minutes a game or something like that. But
I don't know. I mean, they might go even more time. Of course, they have a lot of players in their rotation, so probably not, but certainly Channing Frye and another shooter to spread the floor makes it much easier for a Gortat or a Lynn or a Plumlee to dive to the basket on a pick and roll, while those guys are out on the three-point line in the corners and Bledsoe and Dragic are taking turns driving to the hole and setting up the point, the pick and roll. I think Bledsoe actually has surprised me at how good he is at trying to get pick and rolls and lobs and inside baskets set up. The guys just aren't ready for a lot of his passes right now. And Dragic is really good in the crafty way of setting other people up, too, and finishing on his own. So that's potentially a pretty interesting lineup, and you could have any of the top three centers in that center position. Alex Len has done pretty well. In fact, in his light minutes this spring, Alex Len is still averaging almost six rebounds a game, just barely behind Gortat for a team lead. And Plumlee, of course, is a guy who impressed in the scrimmage and a lot of practices and stuff, but hasn't shown it in games yet. But he's potentially, and he's only a second-year guy as well, he's potentially a good rotation spot.
Yeah, the scrimmage all-stars are always fun when they get into the games and then kind of seeing how that translates. But I'm glad we ran long today because we ended up, you know, having a day late there on the podcast. So I wanted to run a little bit long for everybody out there. So hopefully everyone's got a quality jogging material going. So I know Breaking Bad's not out there. You can't watch it while jogging and multitask. So, you know, don't go out there and watch, you know, terrible shows and force yourself to watch those. Just listen to the podcast. Throw that up there when you're jogging. Got a good quality, like 40, 45 minutes out of us today. And hopefully it was some entertaining stuff. We jumped around on a lot of different things. But to close it out on a positive positive note for Amari. Dave bashed him earlier and said that he was an MVP leading a 500 team. You know, before they hit a six-game losing streak just before the Carmelo trade, and I think some injuries had to do with it, they were actually perpetually 5 to 6 games over 500 early on and were actually playing pretty good ball. They just hit a little bit of a lull in January right before the Carmelo trade, losing 6 in a row. So they were a winning team, and Amari was a borderline all-star candidate.
All right. I'll give you that much.
Again, the three-year-old podcast is now over, so all that stuff from 2010, 2011. That'll be it. We'll have another Brightsider on next week with the podcast. It'll be on time on Wednesday. We apologize for the day delay, but definitely thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week with episode 43.